May 3, 2003. The three men, members of Mantis Company, slipped out the open hatch of the C-130 transport as it flew 65,000 feet above the world. They had trained for this jump countless times. Their gear, ballistic helmets, oxygen masks, Aerox O2 regulators, bailout bottles, all fastidiously maintained, assured them a successful landing. Altimeters marked their belly-to-earth rate of descent at 115 miles per hour. Minutes of freefall were spent in an effortless dive, with the men dropping in formation still and straight. Automatic activation devices engaged the parachutes 800 feet before impact, the lowest altitude allowed for combat high-altitude low-opening jumps. They descended through the low cloud covering like missiles, emerging out of nothingness beneath a starless pre-dawn sky. Their landings, each completed with a puma's grace, would have made their instructors back at Quantico proud. Perfection. Mantis demanded nothing less. In silence, the three exchanged their polypropylene undergarments, vital to protect against frostbite at high altitudes, for white cotton robes and the traditional head coverings of Taliban fighters. Then they zippered shut their 50-pound combat packs. Wearing their dusty garments, the men anticipated they would not immediately rouse any suspicion. Each of the three had a tanning booth tan, supplemented by professionally applied makeup, as well as a closely trimmed mustache and a fully grown beard. Moving stealthily, the trio blended in with their surroundings, a mountainous, rocky region in southern Afghanistan, barren as a moonscape.
"Any injuries?"
"No, Sergeant,"
the two men replied in unison.
"Miller, how many clicks to the target?"
Miller checked his handheld GPS.
5 kilometers south-southwest of the target, Sergeant.
Gibson, ditch the gear."
Gibson knew not to look long for a suitable location in which to hide their parachutes and other equipment. By the time any Afghani stumbled upon the array of high-tech military paraphernalia hidden behind a jagged boulder, it hopefully would be too late. They walked in single file, moving silently across the rock-strewn terrain, with Miller and his GPS taking the lead. Behind them, dawn rose in streaks of brilliant pinks, yellows, and blues, giant fingers extending skyward, beckoning the new day. If anyone had checked the men's pulses at that moment, none would be above 50 beats per minute. Miller found the road, a rutted stretch of dirt that would carry them to the outskirts of Kewa, a town of 20,000 that would look the same today as it did a century and a half ago. Young women wearing chadors stopped farming the fields of wheat, rice, and vegetables lining the roadside to give the trio a cursory glance before quickly resuming their duties. The Marines' disguises were good enough so that none of the women bothered with a closer inspection. They had estimated that unless their luck was extremely bad, they could survive 12 hours or so before they were identified by soldiers or one of the villagers. Way more than enough time. The men of Mantis Company reached the crumbling clay brick walls of Kewa's borders without incident. The town was defined by its absences. No cars, no electricity, no running water. Evidence of 20 years of war was seen everywhere. Craters left by bombs and landmines made what limited roads there were treacherous to pass even on foot. Bombed-out buildings and homes were in greater number than habitable ones. The smells of the market guided the men toward their destination. They wandered about casually through shabby stalls built of boards, sheets, and mud, and bunched together on each side of a single-lane dirt road. The central market was already bustling, despite the newness of the day. In some stalls, slabs of fly-covered meat dangled like macabre wind chimes, while blood-stained butchers called out the day's prices in Pashto. Persian music blasted from cheap radios as the Marines continued their stroll past stalls selling fruit, breads, and rudimentary household supplies. 2 hours had brought a sweltering mid-morning before they caught the attention of a town elder.
"Don't look now," Gibson said, his voice hushed.
but it looks like we've been noticed.
The Afghani, with a white beard descending to his chest, carrying a Kalashnikov assault rifle, approached the men the way he might a poisonous snake. The three Marines turned their backs to the man and moved well away from the women and children in the crowded market. To the extent they could control it, this operation was going to be soldiers only. When they finally stopped, the Afghani took two cautious steps toward them, then a third. His dark eyes narrowed. Then he began to shout and point frantically. His shrill voice rose above the market's din, catching the attention of more men dressed in dirty gray or white robes, each, it seemed, carrying a weapon different in make and age from the others. The commotion rapidly crescendoed, with more Afghani men, some armed, some not, racing up from all directions to surround the intruders. They were screaming, shouting in Pashto, and pointing long, dirt-encrusted fingernails at the three men now trapped inside the rapidly expanding circle.